and had a sense of the amount of contribution. And the smart money seems to be, if excuse the expression, that it was Aleš Deripaska, the metals magnate, who contributed that. Now, inevitably, something of a big deal has been made of this in the West, and in particular, those who want to claim that it demonstrates that the Russian economy is in crisis and so forth have been to the fore. I think we need to be a little bit cautious. First of all, look, the notion of windfall taxes, which is in effect what this is hardly unfamiliar in the West, as indeed it isn't to Russia. I mean, that very same day, Economy Minister Maxim Reshetnikov said that he was considering another windfall tax if the ruble continues to weaken, because there are particularly certain companies which benefit quite dramatically as a result. And back in 2023, the Russians raised 320 billion rubles, which at the time was just under £3 billion, through a one-off 10% windfall levy on some of the larger companies. So this is, you know, nothing necessarily new. And in many ways, it also is an appropriately feudal kind of tax. This is Putin essentially saying to these people, you have all been beneficiaries of the Kremlin's support, largesse, and tolerance in the past. Well, now the bill is coming due. You're not exactly impoverished. You can afford to chip in. And it also is faintly reminiscent of back in 2005, there was this passing round the hat to various oligarchs and corporations to provide monies notionally for the national project health, which obviously sounds like a very good cause, although in practice a large chunk of this money was actually diverted, with everyone's knowledge, to build Putin's palace at Gelenjik on the Black Sea coast. So, you know, there is something of a tradition of these points when actually everyone's expected to chip in. And it doesn't necessarily demonstrate that the economy is in crisis. It is rather that this is a good time to raise funds because Russian businesses are cashing in on surging prices for oil, for gas, for fertilizer, for various other commodities, courtesy of the war in the Middle East. In the open part of the meeting with and the Union of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs, Putin actually warned business people against getting being too carried away by the immediate opportunities, saying, we need to keep our heads. If markets swing one way today, they may swing the other way tomorrow. And in fact, it's perfectly true. I mean, the Russians are treating this as a short-term bonus rather than the new economic normal. But, of course, from Putin's point of view, yes, of course he wants money. I mean, point one, name me one government that says, we have quite enough revenue at the moment, thanks very much. It would be greedy to ask for more. Of course, governments want money. But also, in particular, from Putin's point of view, the key thing is not that the economy is about to collapse. It is rather that the more spare cash available in the Treasury, not only the greater the chance of staving off cuts in public spending that might breed political disenchantment, but also it delays the point at which he can no longer afford to recruit for the special military operation by offering volunteers huge sums of money. And that's when you have to make the really tough decisions about maybe having to use conscripts or mobilize reservists, which again will have a huge political price tag. So, you know, this is just simply taking advantage of the opportunity to extend a certain window of opportunity to avoid making the war genuinely Russia's war. Significant then, but not signs of a crisis. However, one particular aspect that did catch my eye was that, according to the Bell sources, and on the whole, the Bell has very good sources, it's worth noting, the whole idea of this quote-unquote voluntary donation originated with Igor Sechin, Putin's longtime ally, the CEO of Russia's largest oil company, Rosneft. But why that was quite striking for me is since 2022, Sechin has been keeping a surprisingly low profile. So I thought it was a good opportunity to take a look at the man, the myth, and the mightily unpleasant stories around this fellow. And doing so, I was thinking, I thought I had covered Sechin in a podcast. And I look back and it turns out it was actually in the second ever issue, edition, call them what you will, of In Moscow Shadows back in 2020, in which I was comparing him with Prime Minister Mikhail Mishustin as case studies of institutional versus personal power. You might want to go back and listen if you want. It's only just over half an hour. Interesting for me, actually, how the style and pace of the podcast has changed over that time, because it's not like I tend to go back and re-listen to old episodes. But anyway, there it is. So I think I can safely retread this territory. And well, one of the things you'll immediately encounter when you start looking at Sechin is this claim that he's known not only as the Grey Cardinal, but also as Russia's Darth Vader. And, I mean, I was tempted to dub over on this point the Imperial March. But the trouble is that I can't help thinking that this is one of these nicknames that are generated by journalists. And other people think, well, I hadn't heard that, but still, that's interesting, and that's a good bit of copy. And it gets used, and then it gets picked up by the Russians themselves and used. I have a feeling, for example, that General Apocalypse for General Surovikin is another one of these things that, yes, now you'll find Russian outlets using it, but I honestly don't think they were. But anyway, Russia's Darth Vader, and it's really quite appropriate. If Putin is the wizened emperor figure, Darth Vader is this large, burly, imposing and powerful henchman. But, well, look, this is certainly what Sechin was, but I'm not sure if it's really what Sechin is. He is certainly, it has to be said, not a nice chap. Sycophantic to his boss, a bully to everyone below him, known for also his extraordinarily foul mouth. But he is also presenting a case study in how it can be advantageous to be, or to have been, Putin's literal bag carrier. We have this footage and photos of him back in the days when Putin was deputy mayor of St. Petersburg and Sechin was his aide. Of absolutely, it was Sechin who was carrying his bags and doing everything else. Sechin was indeed the man who sharpened Putin's pencils, which, as I say that, I really feel I should stress that I meant that literally and not as some kind of ribald and dirty euphemism, because that does bring a terrible image to mind. So, let's look at his career in very broad terms. I mean, his early career, he studied at Leningrad State University, again, Putin's alma mater, but not in Putin's class or anything like that. In fact, he was a linguist, and he then worked as a Soviet interpreter in Mozambique and Angola. And the pretty substantial suggestions are, some people say he was KGB. I don't think so. I think it was more likely that he was GRU, because it's very much the kind of classic pattern of GRU officers that, you know, they're often military interpreters. Anyway, then civilian life, he served at the office of the St. Petersburg mayoralty. He was became Putin's chief of staff in 1994, still carrying Putin's bags. And then when Putin's patron, Mayor Sobchak, lost the elections and Putin went to Moscow, well, Sechin went with him, became his deputy, for example, 1997-8, as head of the general department in the main control directorate, which is what Putin was doing within the presidential administration before he went on to become director of the FSB, and then following that, prime minister, heir apparent, and acting president. And in that time, I mean, there was this fascinating, I think quite telling little anecdote that Putin and Sechin were both allocated apartments by the government administration. And apparently Putin's nose was very much put out of joint by the fact that his deputy had received an apartment which was 4 square meters. Yes, 4 whole square meters larger than his own. Still, Putin was nonetheless perfectly willing to use Sechin's apartment, it seems, for assignations with his mistress. And what seems to have happened, because this was happening during the day, Sechin's wife, his first wife, realised that there had been another woman present in the apartment and, clearly suspicious, interrogated Sechin about this, and he broke and admitted that, in fact, it was that the flat was being used by Putin for this purpose. And, in fact, Sechin's wife then told Putin's wife, Lyudmila, and that was one more fracture in what doesn't seem to have been a very happy relationship. Anyway, Sechin continued to be Putin's loyal factotum, and when Putin went to the presidency, then Sechin went with him. He would serve as deputy chief of staff, deputy head of the presidential administration, 2000 to 2008. Then, when Medvedev came in that period of the so-called castling, in which Putin was technically prime minister, Medvedev president, well, he became deputy prime minister, overseeing energy policy. He was overseeing energy policy because he was essentially wearing two hats, appropriate for his two faces, some might say, because in 2004, he had also been made chair of Rosneft, the oil corporation, and he was then playing a crucial role in the persecution of Mikhail Khodorkovsky and then the subsequent breakup and confiscation of his Yukos oil empire. And frankly, I mean, it is clear that had been one of Sechin's key goals, to be able to plunder Yukos. Khodorkovsky himself said the second as well as the first case, legal cases against him, were organised by Sechin. He orchestrated the first case against me out of greed and the second out of cowardice. Now, in 2011, when Medvedev, still president, said that senior officials had to resign from roles in large companies, which, I mean, A, I think makes sense, and B, speaks actually to Medvedev's credit, you know, one has to recognise that certainly early Medvedev did show signs of promise. It's a shame the trajectory he's taken since. Anyway, he resigned from Rosneft. But then when Putin became president in 2012, he was no longer needed to keep an eye on Medvedev, so he abandoned his position as deputy prime minister, returned to Rosneft as CEO and chair of the board, and that's been his role ever since. So is he, as some would say, kind of the grey cardinal behind Putin? Not really. Maybe once upon a time he had a lot more influence than he does now, but nor is he, as some would suggest, a so-called silovark, sort of compound of oligarch and silovik, you know, these oligarchs who came from the security apparatus. Yeah, he once did seem to stand as, in some ways, the kind of representative, the tribune of the security and intelligence services. But to be honest, that was a long, long time ago, and it was never that critical. And certainly, in my own conversations since then, with people from the security world, I never got the sense from them that they felt that Sechin was their guy. They really regarded him as having just simply become an oil baron. And that's that. You also occasionally get his name raised as a potential successor to Putin. That was never in the frame. He was never really a political appointee. He was an administrative crony and then a businessman. But of course, a very, very privileged crony. We can see this, for example, about his whole business approach. You know, there's some debate about how good he is as actually a CEO. I have a suspicion that he's not very good, because what he can do is he can, if need be, rely on his political clout in order sort of to be a pretty cannibalistic actor within the Russian economy, using this clout to absorb other entities when he needs the money. And we saw this particularly in the acquisition of a rival oil corporation, Bashneft. And why that's particularly significant is, well, that led to the rather extraordinary case in 2016 of the arrest of Alexei Ulyukayev. Now, Alexei Ulyukayev was the Minister for Economic Development, and in November 2016, he was arrested and charged with having demanded and extorted a $2 million bribe from Sechin in order to lift his opposition to the Bashneft takeover. Now, Ulyukayev himself says he was invited to go and meet Sechin in his offices, and Sechin gave him a basket as a sort of gift, which is not that unusual within Russian business etiquette. Frankly, just as it probably wouldn't be that unusual to expect some kind of gift for, again, allowing something through. How many Russian officials, let's face it, especially senior ones, live on their salaries alone? I think we have a very round number because, frankly, 0% is as round a number as you can get. But anyway, he thought really it was just a basket with kind of token gifts, like sort of. Sechin is an infamously passionate hunter. Doesn't that come as a surprise? And he often gives, for example, you know, sausages made from animals that he has butchered and the like as gifts. And that's what Ilyukayev claims that he thought he was getting. But anyway, he was then arrested. It's fairly obvious that he was framed, particularly by the use of the so-called The Six, which was a team within the FSB's Internal Security Service under General Oleg Feoktistov, who then coincidentally became head of security for, guess what, Rosneft. Anyway, Ulyukayev was arrested. A fairly transparent frame had been arranged in order to punish Ulyukayev by Sechin, who didn't even then bother, despite repeatedly being summoned, to actually give evidence in court. But nonetheless, Ulyukayev, and this is ultimately because Putin was uncomfortable with the case, but nonetheless backed his guy, Sechin, was then sentenced to 8 years in prison, though he was paroled in 2022. So it's a real case of personal vendetta. By that stage, the Bashneft deal was going through. But Ulyukayev had stood against it, and therefore Ulyukayev had to be made to suffer, and to be made to suffer in a really demonstrable way that showed that Sechin really didn't have to worry about even preserving the appearance of following the laws. So that is this charming fellow. But the interesting thing is, since 2022, since the invasion, he's been surprisingly quiet, very much just simply focusing on Rosneft and only really commenting on the very immediate business dealings of his corporation, which again is out of character for Sechin beforehand. He was even actually relatively quiet over the kidnap of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela. And why that's significant is, remember the way that the Russian adhocracy works is that formal responsibilities are often not the same as real responsibilities. And certainly the foreign ministry has lost control of certain sort of areas of policy. Syria essentially became a defense ministry holdout, for example. When he was Secretary of the Security Council, Patrushev dominated policy over the Balkans. And Sechin, given the oil factor, was essentially dominating policy over Venezuela. But nonetheless, when you have Maduro taken, when you have Trump trying to sort of build a new relationship with Venezuela, what does Sechin say about it? Very, very little. But nonetheless, bit by bit, he's been returning to the news in the past year. And I think that tells us something about the situation, but also about how Russia works. So I'll talk about that after the break. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counterterrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galeotti or on Facebook, Mark Galeotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. One of the things you soon learn looking at Sechin is the degree to which he has become something of a folk devil to so many, not just within the liberal opposition, such that they are prepared to listen to, recount and amplify pretty much any rumour that paints him as this dark and baleful force behind everything that's going on. So, for example, we've had recently this wild claim that Sechin now effectively runs the military. First of all, that's rooted in the supposed and, I think, entirely mythical role that he's meant to have played in Shoigu's removal as defence minister. So the claim is that there was an alliance between Chemizov, Bortnikov, Karalyov, Kovalchuk, Sechin, Krasnov and Tkachev. Now, let's unpick that for a moment. Chemizov, head of the Rostec Arms Corporation. Bortnikov, director of the Federal Security Service. Karalyov, first deputy director and heir apparent. Kovalchuk, well, we're talking about Yuri Kovalchuk, not the ice hockey player. Yuri Kovalchuk, the chairman and largest shareholder of Bank Rossiya. Sechin himself, Krasnov, prosecutor general turned chairman of the Supreme Court, and Tkachev, of whom more in a moment, but senior FSB officer. So the idea that all of them somehow formed an alliance against an even wilder claim, a Shoigu, Patrushev, Medvedev and Timchenko, Gennady Timchenko, the oligarch, alliance. I mean, there is absolutely no evidence, but still you will find this claim circulating all sorts of places in social media in particular. And then, particularly, this was given even greater form with the news of the appointment of Lieutenant General Ivan Tkachev, who I mentioned, as head of the Federal Security Service's Military Counterintelligence Department, the DVKR, in September of last year. Now, back in December of 2024, the previous head, Colonel General Nikolai Yuryev, had been dismissed following the murder of, if you remember, General Igor Kirillov, who had been head of the radiation, chemical and biological, I always forget the order of those, defense troops in Moscow in what seems to have been a Ukrainian intelligence hit. So Yuryev was forced to go down, and then there was a dispute over who was going to replace him. And originally, it seemed as if the job was simply going to go to his deputy, Vice Admiral Pavel Boyko. In fact, though, it ended up going to Tkachev, who up to that point had been head of the Economic Security Services Directorate K. And this is all framed as Sechin's work, because Tkachev was originally one of the so-called Sechin Spetsnaz, this essentially suborned group of people within the FSB's Internal Security Directorate, who, amongst other things, had arranged the framing of Ulyukayev. But the point is that, well, first of all, that was then. I mean, 10 years ago, Tkachev was one of the senior figures within this group, the so-called the Sixth. But look, a lot can happen in 10 years. Most of these kind of patron-client relationships are very transactional and often really quite temporary. And there's very little evidence that Sechin had been doing much for Tkachev in the intervening 10 years. So first of all, again, the fact that once there was a connection does not necessarily prove that there is now. That's a very, very common problem we find with Kremlinology, along with the idea that if people sort of served or studied or whatever together, they have some kind of alliance. Often they can actually end up hating each other. But perhaps more important, the DVKR is, you know, quite important as a sort of role. It's quite a large directorate, but it is neither lucrative nor prestigious. Indeed, actually, to be head is quite a perilous position if, as is quite likely, these assassinations of senior Russian military figures continue, because you are basically the one who's going to be primarily blamed for it. On the other hand, any Economic Security Service position, well, I mean, ka-ching, that's where the real money is to be made. And actually, Directorate K was particularly true of that, because Directorate K is technically responsible for counterintelligence in the financial sector. So in other words, it gets to oversee banks, the tax agencies, the customs service. This is where the chances for all kinds of major payouts can be found, because you can tilt the outcomes of raiding operations, or you can just simply extort people who have a lot of money to be extorted in the guise of investigating high-profile economic crimes. And also, because it's one of the key instruments that the state can use to bring pressure to bear on business, it's also actually quite politically important. So, arguably, Tkachev gets a technical bump up, but loses a much-prized plum job. So, you know, if that was the gift of Sechin's patronage, then I'm not quite sure whether or not Tkachev actually would appreciate it. But anyway, the point is that because of that, people assume that somehow Sechin can now reach in and control the generals. As I say, see, people seeing his baleful hand everywhere. And even the very fact that it was Belousov, Andrei Belousov, who became Minister of Defence, is seen as somehow a Sechin factor, because Belousov was a while on the Rosneft board. People forget that actually Belousov was very critical of Sechin's policies and actually left the board as a result. So let's be careful about that. Then we also had the journalist Mikhail Sigar, in his opinion column for the New York Times, suggesting that Sechin could actually replace Kirill Dmitriev in as lead economic negotiator in the team talking to the Americans. I'm really not convinced about that. I mean, it could well happen. Žigar often has extraordinarily good sources, but on the other hand, we are relying on anonymous sources. And frankly, a process which for the moment seems to have run into the ground. So we'll wait and see. Also, in summer of 2025, we saw Sechin making some, for him, new overtures about rare earth metals. Because after all, you know, Russia holds about 10% of the world's rare earth metal reserves. And this is increasingly important as a geopolitical factor, given their use in high-tech gadgets from cell phones to fighter planes. Indeed, actually, when he was talking at the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum last year, he framed it in these very geopolitical terms, noting that, you know, the West was trying to now bring together control over these key resources, though actually it's China who's doing that. More on that in a moment. And he very, very explicitly noted that the production of one F-35 fighter, this new all-singing, dancing, all-stealthy fighter that we're seeing currently in use over Iran. Anyway, one of these jets requires 417 kilograms of rare earth metals. Okay, that's fair enough. The reason why that is significant, though, as I say, apart from the China factor, of which more in a moment, is that, again, it was Sechin spreading his, I was going to say spreading his wings, I think of them as rather bat-like ones. Anyway, in ways that he hadn't for a while, and coming out more, again, if I can mix my metaphors, of the shadows. And now we have claims about this, well, let's say shakedown, having been his suggestion. Now, Peskov, Dmitry Peskov, the presidential spokesman, has denied this, has said it's not true that it came from Igor Sechin, it's not true that it was said that the money would go to the special military operation, it's not true that Putin made such a request. Instead, one of the participants argued that the overwhelming majority of those at the meeting started their businesses in the 1990s, and these businesses were primarily connected in one way or another to the state. Therefore, many now consider it their duty to make such contributions. One of the participants said this. It was absolutely his initiative. I kind of have a feeling that you're protesting a little bit too much there, Dima. Anyway, continues, it was not President Putin's initiative, although, of course, the head of state welcomed such an initiative. Yeah, I bet he did. Anyway, look, it may be true, it may not be, but the point is clearly, in one way or another, Sechin is back. So why is this? Well, a key element of that rests in how you define Sechin's relationship with Putin. Some people will, for example, describe him in very neutral terms as an associate, but others suggest that he's a friend of Putin's. That I would question. I've been going back trying to, for example, find evidence of friendly activities, by which I don't mean as a counterpart to hostile ones, but signs that Sechin actually is in Putin's social circle. That he was invited into Putin's sort of group at night league hockey games, that he was partying with Putin, that he was dining with him in anything other than a formal setting, or like Shoigu was taking him hiking, anything like that. I've not been able to find it. And I think it represents the fact that Putin has, we could almost call it a kind of class division, that he very much draws a line between friends and cronies. And clearly, friends also get all the perks of cronies, all the impunities, all the economic opportunities. But nonetheless, they also are in a very special case. I don't think Sechin is a friend. I think he's a crony. And as a crony, you have to keep working that much harder, especially at times when you have particular problems and opportunities and therefore need to demonstrate your continued utility to the boss. Now, problems, well, actually, Rosneft is, like the rest of the Russian oil industry, actually having something of a problem. And he's been lobbying quite hard for government support or at least a lessening of some of the burdens on it. I mean, Rosneft produces about 40% of the country's oil and a quarter of its gas. And, well, it's seen its profits plummet really quite hard, threefold. First half of 2024, 773 billion rubles. First half of last year, 245, so down from 773 to 245. That's really quite a substantial fall. And in fact, by the middle of last year, 45% of all the oil and gas companies in Russia were actually unprofitable, according to data from Rosstat. And their total losses amounted to about 750 billion rubles. And Sechin, in many ways, I mean, you know, basically, because Rosneft and Lukoil are really the two big beasts in this, and then Gazprom more in the gas sector. Sechin is one of the figures who is kind of expected to stand up for the industry. And he certainly has. He's obviously, to a degree, noted the international situation. But in particular, he's been picking fights, first of all, with the central bank, which he says, basically, that their actions have been hurting Rosneft and the oil industry as a whole. But also transport monopolies like Transneft, which do pipelines, and Ergeder, the railways. Because apparently, according to him, their fee structure and their monopolistic positions also treat the oil industry unfairly, because obviously the oil has to be moved around one way or the other. So, you know, essentially he's fighting his industry's corner, both for Rosneft's sake, but also for the industry as a whole, and doing so by essentially challenging other sectors of the economy and the government system. But it's not just a negative thing that actually he finds his back on against the wall to a degree. He can also spot some opportunities that are emerging. I mean, back in November, for example, the Financial Times reported that the collapse of a deal to sell Lukoil's foreign assets to Gunvor, which is the company owned by the aforementioned Gennady Timchenko, formerly owned. Anyway, that sparked a whole new wave of rumours that actually Rosneft might try and take Lukoil, or at least as parts of Lukoil, over, something that Putin had previously blocked. Not sure if it's going to happen, but still, watch this space, because if nothing else, Sechin can use this kind of pressure as a bargaining chip to try and get something else, some other benefit somewhere else. And in fact, maybe he's already cashed that in part, because according to Kommersant, he has actually convinced Putin to reverse his position and revive a project to build a huge petrochemical plant in Primorye, way over the far east of the Russian Federation. Now, this is a project that was shelved in 2019 because of its unprofitability. And Rosneft has been trying to push it ever since. I mean, frankly, Rosneft started pushing this project back in 2009. And Putin was reluctant, not least because we're talking about something which would cost 1.5 trillion rubles. So it's a big deal. The idea being it will create a facility with oil refining capacity, able to handle about 12 million tons per year, as a part of a wider petrochemical complex. This is admittedly an area that does tend to suffer from a severe shortage of domestic oil refining capacity. And also, because it's handily over in the Russian Far East, it can more easily, in due course, service Asian markets and is further away from pesky Westerners and their special forces teams in helicopters that have been of late intercepting shadow fleet tankers. So there's also potentially a geopolitical dimension. But the point is, having been resistant for so long, despite the condition of the national budget, nonetheless, Putin has now given the green light. Which again does suggest that Sechin has had some success in his lobbying efforts. And in part it's also because he is benefiting from the current crisis in the Gulf. Again, back in middle of 2025, he said that Rosneft was essentially basing its estimates on an oil price of $45 per barrel in 2025 and a little bit less, $42 to $43 in 2026. Now, at one point that seemed to be frankly over-optimistic. But now, with oil prices heading up above $100, at least for the moment, Sechin seems to have more opportunities to throw his weight around. But as I say, the point is he has to throw his weight around because he has to demonstrate utility. Now, in part, obviously, this whole point about the shakedown, if it was Sechin, was presumably to try and trap his peers. He came up with the idea and he hopes that that's his contribution, and it's other oligarchs who are actually going to have to stump up the cash. It's a chance to undercut his rivals, and maybe it's a chance to get that bigger piece of the shrinking treasury pie. But we've also seen this over China policy. Now, it's interesting because obviously China is a major buyer of Russian oil and indeed gas, but it also gets it at one hell of a discount. often, frankly, a almost ruinous discount. So you find this generally across the hydrocarbon sector in Russia, a certain ambivalence towards China, a desire to, if we're putting it bluntly, to suck up to the Chinese, but also resentment at the degree to which the Chinese know that full well and use it to drive very, very hard bargains. And bear that in mind when next time you hear talk about this close, almost lockstep alliance between Moscow and Beijing. Anyway, so on the one hand, he has been trying to play the China card. In November, again, at the Russia-China Energy Business Forum, he very much presented sort of Russia as being, I wouldn't say open for business, but basically open for plunder, saying that Russia, with its unique resource base, can guarantee energy security for all of Eurasia. The total value of our country's natural resources is nearly $100 trillion, almost twice that of the United States. And so he was essentially presenting Russia as being willing to provide whatever natural resources China wanted. So on one case, it's looking frankly as if he's almost prostrating China before Russia before the Chinese economy. But at the same time, let's go back to that issue about rare earths and the way Sechin has been hyping it, because that actually fits in with a wider current of concern within the Russian government about the degree to which Russia itself is becoming dependent upon China. The thing is, Russia produces a lot of rare earths, but processing it is expensive, but above all, it is environmentally catastrophic. So what the Russians have been doing up to now is they dig the stuff up, they sell it to the Chinese. The Chinese, who seem to have fewer concerns about quite how disastrous and toxic the industry is, does all the processing, and the Russians buy back what they need. But the point is, that leaves the Russians entirely dependent upon the Chinese for access to these rare earths, which are themselves crucial for advanced technological developments of the sort that Russia would like to move further into. So what we have seen is last year, and it was done very, very quietly, the decision was made to expand the processing of rare earth metals within Russia 50-fold. Now, again, that is significant. Firstly, because it means major investment at a time when, as I say, there are already more pressures on the budget than the budget can truly bear. And secondly, the fact that nonetheless, this was done so quietly. We didn't have a big announcement from Putin, not even convinced Putin was necessarily in the loop. I think this was framed as a purely technical administrative decision. But it clearly represents those people within the administration who are concerned about the current drift of Russia into China's orbit and are doing what they can, given that Putin himself doesn't seem to be that concerned about it. As far as he's concerned, he needs China for his war in Ukraine, and that takes precedence over everything else. So they've been doing it. And in that respect, Sechin has been playing to them as well. His talk about rare earths has very much was raised in support of the argument that this was a necessary process. So, again, here we have Sechin in classic form, essentially playing both sides. He's playing the we need to do more business with China card and also the but we need to be careful of China card. So he is being busy and he's trying to make sure that he actually shores up his support in a variety of different constituencies, not just with Putin, though clearly Putin is the important man. And exactly, this is because he is a crony and he needs to continue to demonstrate his value. And in some ways, the more he's going to want, such as, for example, permission to take over Lukoil assets or some kind of more favourable deal in terms of the payments to the state treasury that are required from the oil and general hydrocarbon sector, well, the more he wants, the more he's going to have to show that he's useful. And in this respect, it is an interesting parallel. This is what I talked about, the Prigozhin syndrome. Is that ultimately, he is never going to become Putin's friend. He's always going to just simply become a useful crony. And all useful cronies, however useful, can be discarded if they no longer become quite so useful. So there is a glass ceiling of sorts, though it is a very, very high one, a very ornate one. It's thoroughly gilded. Maybe even it's a diamond ceiling. The thing is that Sechin, unlike Prigozhin, seems perfectly willing to accept this. So, anyway, one shouldn't feel too sorry for the rasp-voiced troll. I mean, he's twice married, but also, according to FBKR, Navalny's anti-corruption foundation, he also has a virtual harem of escort mistresses, at least one of whom was actually for a long time on the Rosneft payroll. I wouldn't want to see the contract for that. In 2016, he built a sort of massive mansion estate in the exclusive Moscow suburb of Barvika in Rublyovka region, very close to Putin's own. We actually have some insight into his income, thanks to State Duma Deputy Dmitry Gusev, who's a Just Russia deputy. Anyway, he proposed a bill, I think it was last year, that would limit executive compensation so that the maximum salary in an organisation cannot be more than five times the minimum salary. I mean, very progressive, and, well, I know you'll be shocked to hear that it didn't actually pass. But nonetheless, it did generate a certain amount of discussion about the disparities in salaries. And from that, we know that Sechin's annual income in 2024 exceeded 4.6 billion rubles. That's something like 42.5 million UK pounds. Now, that's equivalent to 382.5 million rubles a month, or over 12.6 million rubles, that's £116,000, every day. He earns in one day what an inexperienced employee would earn in 30 years. Or to put it another way, his monthly income is equivalent to that newcomer's salary for almost 638 years. There you go. Then, in January of this year, His Holiness Patriarch Kirill presented Sechin with the Order of St. Sergius of Radonezh, first class. Nothing but first class for him. As a reward for all your good deeds, both for the good of the church and for the good of our fatherland. Ah, bless. He's also a man of, as I've mentioned, legendary malice and a passion for vendettas. And it's not just the Ulyukayev case. Consider Plyos. What you're saying? Plyos is this really quite scenic little town in Ivanovo region, on the right bank of the Volga River. And in 2008, Medvedev visited. And after that, apparently he was blown away by how lovely a little place he was. And after that, apparently he said, Plyos is awesome. I want a residence here. And indeed, so it became. As Navalny reported in 2016, Medvedev was restoring what Navalny called his secret dacha, which is the 18th century Milovka estate with an infamous duck house, amongst other things. Anyway, on the outskirts of Plyos, which is being renovated at an estimated cost of 25 to 30 billion rubles. Okay, fair enough. And with this patronage, as you'd imagine, Plyos developed. And in particular, it was part of this movement that, in a classic sort of new Russian way, takes a Russian word and adds an English language sort of form to it. It's been called Izbing. Izbing. Now, that's from Izba, which is a traditional Russian peasant hut. And it's essentially this process of an often rather chintzy, but also, I've got to be honest, rather picturesque, I think, way of essentially trying to recreate the aesthetics, idealized aesthetics, of the 19th century Russian town. Particular example being Rybinsk in Yaroslavl region, which not only has a centre that is where every shop has to be in that format, but on particular sort of special days, you have even like the local food couriers wearing 19th century style uniforms and the like. Anyway, so it went through this process of economic development, very much as a tourist hub on the Golden Ring, and playing to this Izbing factor under the auspices of Mayor Alexei Shevtsov and Regional Governor Mikhail Men, both of whom, in fairness, also did exceedingly well, making a pile of money in the process for themselves. But anyway, after he had stood down, Shevtsov suddenly found himself foreign agented and slapped with a bunch of lawsuits, essentially demanding that he hand over property. And this was happening in the tenure of his successor, one Timur Bulat Karimov. Who? Well, it just so happens that Timur Bulat is Sechin's son-in-law, having married Sechin's daughter Inga. And the couple had begun buying up property in the city, 10 buildings, houses. They become the owner of the Plyos Shipping Company, which runs tourist cruises along the Volga, then bought the Fortress Hotel on the banks of the Volga, adjacent to Medvedev's estate. And that actually may be a clue to what's happening, because under normal circumstances, one wouldn't have thought that if you were Sechin's son-in-law, your first thought is, I really need to build myself a little empire in a small provincial tourist town. Now, remember, it may have been years before, but nonetheless, Medvedev and Sechin had been really fighting quite a bitter rivalry over who was going to be Putin's crony-in-chief. And also, it had been Medvedev who had forced Sechin to give up, if only for a little while, his control of Rosneft. These are not the kind of things that Sechin forgets. And according to a former official, how did Timur Bulat even end up there? It's actually quite strange. A small town, not particularly resource-rich, and Sechin's son-in-law is heading there. Why? Medvedev had a historic conflict with Sechin, so they decided to make sure Medvedev didn't feel like it was his territory. They didn't want him to feel like, oh, I've arrived at my estate and I've got everything under control. And this official was also noting that at the same time, back in 2019, another of Sechin's people, Stanislav Voskresensky, was appointed governor of Ivanovo region after Mien. So this is how Sechin rolls. I mean, look, he has had a long rivalry with Medvedev. At one point, the two of them, after all, were vying to be Putin's crony-in-chief. And he clearly didn't forget. And even after the point when Medvedev had long since lost his role, lost his plot, some would say, he was still determined that he was going to ruin his little Plyos idyll. That's how Sechin rolls. Find out what brings joy to a rival, and then step on it heavily and repeatedly. Now look, as the Putin regime, well, some might say matures, some might say approaches senescence, I'm thinking probably I'm more on the latter side of things, you know, Sechin is still part of this shrinking, trusted inner circle, one that prioritizes loyalty over competence, and particularly performative displays of loyalty, making the system more brittle, less willing to tolerate dissenting advice in the process. It's okay for Sechin right now, but that's the point. That is the life of the crony. You are constantly remembering that you have this extraordinarily privileged life so long as the boss finds you useful, so long as the boss doesn't have to choose between you and one of his friends or you and someone who is more useful. So far, Sechin's done a bloody good job of that. He is, nonetheless, still having to sharpen Putin's pencils. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page. That's beneficiaries of the Kremlin's support, largesse, and tolerance in the past. Well, now the bill is coming due. You're not exactly impoverished. You can afford to chip in. And it also is faintly reminiscent of back in 2005. There was this passing round the hat to various oligarchs and corporations to provide monies notionally for the national project health, which obviously sounds like a very good cause, although in practice a large chunk of this money was actually diverted, with everyone's knowledge, to build Putin's palace at Gelenjik on the Black Sea coast. So, you know, there is something of a tradition of these points when actually everyone's expected to chip in. And it doesn't necessarily demonstrate that the economy is in crisis. It is rather that this is a good time to raise funds because Russian businesses are cashing in on surging prices for oil, for gas, for fertilizer, for various other commodities, courtesy of the war in the Middle East. In the open part of the meeting with, again, the Union of Industrialists and Entrepreneurs, Putin actually warned business people against getting being sort of too carried away by the immediate opportunities, saying, we need to keep our heads. If markets swing one way today, they may swing the other way tomorrow. And in fact, it's perfectly true. I mean, the Russians are treating this as a short-term bonus rather than the new economic normal. But, of course, from Putin's point of view, yes, of course he wants money. I mean, point one, name me one government that says, we have quite enough revenue at the moment, thanks very much. It would be greedy to ask for more. Of course, governments want money. But also, in particular, from Putin's point of view, the key thing is not that the economy is about to collapse. What you doing uptown? Hey, white boy, you chasing all women around. Oh, pardon me, sir, it's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to different in my mind. I'm waiting for my man. He comes, he's all dressed in black. He wore shoes and a big straw hat.
Radio Klebnikov.
Ich bin die Panzerkreuzer-Kapitän und ich weiß nicht, wohin ich fahre. Ich hab uns noch nicht. Dienstag. Diese Meister wohnt direkt von der Welt. Schildere auf Dienstag ist ein Stück von der Welt erobere. Ein Einzelgänger bin ich nun auf diesem ganz verrückten Boot. Ein Einzelgänger. Et je pense à vous. I'm the captain of the Panzer. Der englischen Frau. And I don't know where I'm going to. Eine Mann, die Panzerkreuz. Ein Entführer. Und ich weiß nicht, wohin ich fahre. Pale Blue Eyes. Ich weiß nicht, wohin ich fahre. Le moment décisif, c'est un moment trop tard. Ein Einzelgänger bin ich nun. Auf diesem ein ganz verrückten Boot bin ich nun. Auf diesem ganz verrückten Boot bin ich ein Einzelgänger. Aber wo sind meine Freunde nun? Ich kann nur hoffen, sie hätten irgendwo etwas Freude und Frieden gefunden. Ich liebe sie. Ich liebe sie. Ich liebe sie. Je pense à vous. Ich bin die Panzerkreuzkapitän. Und ich weiß nicht, an wen ich fahre. Where I'm going to. Le moment décisif. C'est un moment trop tard. Du bist mein Panzerkreuzkapitän. Dinsdag is de meest arrogante dag van de week. Du bist mein Panzerkreuzkapitän. Je pense à vous. Ich liebe dich. Wo sind meine Freunde nur? Aber wo sind meine Freunde nur? Ich kann nur hoffen, sie hätten irgendwo etwas Freude und Frieden gefunden. Ich liebe sie. Ich liebe sie. Ich liebe sie. Gerrit Achterberg.
Ich liebe dich.
Ovoïde. Ik ben een ei in het midden van voorheen. Een bril die door mijn dooier ziet.
Ik liebe dich.
Bemerkt de dikke slierten van begin. Dat werkt. De stilte staat met de randen om mij heen.
Ik liebe dich.
De handen die mij vinden worden steen. Binnen en buiten, wederzijds beperkt.
Ik liebe dich.
Langs de ovale schaal zijn even sterk en hebben met elkaar geen punt gemeen. Ik kan niet breken, want er is geen stoot. Ik kan niet sterven, want er is geen dood. Gestadig gaan de bloedmiljoenen rond, schuimend van hart tot hart, van mond tot mond. Columbus ligt de kraaien in zijn graf. Amerika komt langzaam op hem af.
Lijkt daar geen oor. De economische recessie ziet ook de stad Mechelen zich genoodzaakt om fors te besparen in 2012. Kan veiligheid en ontdek hoe u met Essent energie en geld bespaart. Voorbeeldfactuur. Energietips. Geld besparen door bewuster om te gaan met energie. Meer informatie. Meer informatie. Een handige manier om geld te besparen is thuis zelf een romantisch diner te organiseren. Geld besparen doe je hier. Alles gratis. Net. Hoe extreem besparen? Energie besparen door zonne-energie door middel van je PV-panelen en zonnepanelen. Besparen en schuldbemiddeling probeert mensen die in de collectieven en waar moet u opletten bij de aankoop van nieuwe huishoudtoestellen. Hoe kunt u besparen op verlichting? Besparen. Alle werkwoordvormen. Op mijn woordenboek kunt u eenvoudig werkwoorden vervoegen in het Nederlands, Frans, Duits, Engels en Spaans. De VN hopen dit jaar te kunnen stoppen met de vredesmacht in Oost-Timor. De missies naar Haiti en Liberia worden verkleind. Momenteel zijn meer besparen op je budget. Tips, weetjes en gouden raad voor een budgetvriendelijk leven met je zin op en meer. Besparen, ja, maar ook perspectief bieden. Maandag 30.01.2012, 20:21. Voormalig minister en SPA zegt dat er veel mensen in ons land. Het leven wordt met de dag duurder. Toch kan u met eenvoudige dingen veel geld besparen. Wij vroegen onze lezers hoe zij dat aan boord. Er wordt bespaard, ook buiten de vergoedingen om. Terwijl een gewone burger een loopbaan van 40 jaar moet volmaken om recht te hebben. Voeding neemt steeds een grotere hap uit het budget. Het is een van de minst samendrukbare posten in het gezinsbudget. Eerst wordt beknibbeld. Het ACW vindt de oosterweelverbinding te duur. Als er met de economische crisis drastisch bespaard moet worden in Vlaanderen en door de NA het communitaire luik van de onderhandelingen, komt de begroting op tafel. Dat wordt geen wandeling in het park. De bankencrisis van papier besparen. Halt. Begroting op tafel. Dat wordt geen wandeling in het park. Ik ga het echt eens zeggen.